Okay. And we are off. All right. Hi, everybody. I hope your Hanukkah was enjoyable. We're getting back to business, back to our business of studying Pirkei Avot. I'm just getting this farm ready. And we are now on. We are now moving on from Mishnah 10 in the first parak, that of Shemaya, and we are moving on to, let me just adjust this a little bit, and we are moving on to the Mishnah, to his partner of Talion. The truth of the matter is, I'd like to put together the last statement by Shemaya and the first statement by and the statement by Avtalion. Shemaya, you will recall, we spent a lot of time talking about this, said as follows: Shemaya, Shemaya Omer, Shemaya used to say, Ehov et amlecha, love work, usna et harabanut, and hate the rabbinate or hate authority, ve'al titvada l'rashut. Don't get too close to the government. Interestingly, Avtalion seems to be going in the same direction, and he says, Avtalion Omer, Chachamim hizaru b'divrechem. O sages, be careful of what you say. This is before Facebook and Twitter, right? Hizaru b'divrechem, Shema tachuvu chuvat galut, lest you say something, and you end up being exiled because of it. V'tiglu l'makom mayim harayim, and you'll be exiled to a place of bad waters. V'yishtu atalmidim habayim achreichem v'yamutu, and your students will... Excuse me, will come and drink of the bad waters. When they come to study with you, they'll follow you, and they will die. The nimtza shem shamayim mitchalel, and the name of God will end up being desecrated. Okay, so there's a lot of different ways to be able to try to hang and to address the import of these two statements. One thing is very clear, and that is that both Shemaya and Avtalion were very, very wary. We're very conscious of the dangers involved in general in going into politics or in taking public positions, number one. And number two, especially if we're talking about rabbis. Especially if we're talking about rabbis for the simple reason that rabbis are not just, no rabbi is a private person. It doesn't matter if you're in a public position. It doesn't matter if you're a. It doesn't matter if you're head of a major head of a yeshiva. It doesn't matter if you're in a political party. It you can just be a simple, you know, person with smicha. But the minute you use your title, you by definition represent the Torah. I know it might not be fair. It might not be appropriate. It doesn't matter. People will always extrapolate from the fact that you have a rabbinic title, and Bizman Hazeh, nowadays it doesn't. That would include Rabbaniyot, because the point is precisely the same. The minute that a rav or a rabbanit or whatever does something wrong, a talmid chachama does something which can be distorted or misrepresented, by definition, that person exposes themselves to causing a chilul Hashem. In general, that is the definition. It's interesting. The Rambam doesn't do this. Why he doesn't is another issue. But the Rambam and Chazal, following Chazal, make a point of saying that ultimately, the definition of a chilul Hashem, of desecrating God's name, and sanctifying God's name, the definition is not to be found in whether you're ready to martyr yourself or not. Okay? The definition is whether your daily behavior and your daily comportment, when you are identified as a representative of Torah, speaks well of the Torah generally or ill of the Torah generally. Or as Chazal say, Ru masab shel ploni, you look at the way so-and-so acts. If he does something which is sketchy, ma ra'im ma'asav, as arur ha'adam, cursed be the person, or it's a horrible thing for such a person to learn Torah. And if your comportment is appropriate and arises inspiration, the opposite is true. Ashrei Adam Shelamad Torah, happy is the person who learns Torah. So having a public career is a dicey business. On the other hand, we are not a monastic culture. We are not a monastic. We believe in a in being publicly active. So how do you balance those two things? Because it's very easy to be to get caught up and get corrupted. So I think and interestingly, by the way, Shmaya Naftali and Hart came in the generation after Shimon ben Shetach. Shimon ben Shetach, we told you, I mentioned to you, was the brother-in-law of Shlom Tzion, was the brother, rather, of Shlom Tzion HaMalka. He was a political figure. He was involved in government. He was a frequent visitor at his sister and brother-in-law's palace. Alexander Yanai was the king, was also not a great friend of rabbinic Judaism. Question is whether Shmaya Naftali, who came afterwards, they were his students, whether they were saying, you know, maybe you have to keep a business. Maybe there's no place for rabbis in politics, because it's always going to end up badly. I don't know if it definitely is going to always end up badly, but certainly there are greater dangers involved than might otherwise be true of other people. Although, truth of the matter is that politics has such a bad reputation today that it might be true of everybody. Nevertheless, it's important to not to hide. Where, as I said, we're not a monastic society. We don't believe in the Torah teaches you should be involved in the world, and you should try to. Okay, Tikkun Olam is forget about it. It's an abused word, but you're supposed to make a contribution to society. You can't a person as Hillel will later say, "Yemein ani li mi, imani la atzmi mani." If I don't take care of myself, then I'm actually not worth anything. That's in the next generation. So you have to be able to balance. So I think what Shmaya was saying when he says that al titvadal l'rashut, notice the word, he doesn't say don't get involved. He doesn't say al titarev al tiyem ma'orav barashut, don't get involved in government, don't serve the public good. He says al titvadal l'rashut. That's very different. I think what he's saying is don't let it go to your head. Make every effort not to get sucked in. You have to work overtime to make sure that you keep your integrity, to make sure that you keep your nose clean. And it might be very, very hard. But it's one thing to be a public servant. It's another thing not to be walk down the dark side of things. When it comes to political involvement, al titvadal l'rashut, don't go native. Make sure, think three times, four times, five times before you get sucked into the seamy things which will violate your integrity. Because at the end of the day, all you have is your good name. And since the Torah says you're not allowed to besmirch your good name, The Torah, when the 2.5 tribes come to Moshe Rabbeinu and say we want to settle on the other side of the Jordan, but we will come in and we will help our brethren conquer the land. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, well, you know, you build cities and keep your families and whatever on the eastern side of the Jordan, and then you're going to come and fight with us. So if you do all that, v'yitem nekiyim mi'Hashem Yisrael. If you do that, then you will be clean, you will be blameless, you will be upstanding, you'll be able to be respected both by in the eyes of God and in the eyes of man. Chazal take that verse to mean that you have an obligation. You're absolutely forbidden to cause yourself to be besmirched. You're good. There were three things that in the Torah, which by the way it's interesting. It's the exact opposite of contemporary society. There are three things that people don't own. One is we don't own our lives. We can't decide just whether we can live or die. Suicide is prohibited for that reason. Yes, it raises moral questions and all kinds of stuff, but the bottom line is, the point of departure is, we don't own our lives, we don't own our bodies, and we don't own our reputations. That's what Maris Ayin means. Marit Ayin, you shouldn't do something which will lead somebody to say that you were actually sinning, because that's a comment on you. And you're not allowed to make yourself look bad. And you're not allowed to, and the ramifications of Chilul Hashem, of desecrating God's name, are also there. Now, so how do you measure that, you know, how do you measure that that difference? How do you be able to, so it's a challenge. Being involved in public life is a challenge. You have to be careful what you say, and here we're going to segue into Avtalia. You have to watch what you say. You have to be careful what you say. You have to be careful what you do. You have to work on appearances. It's a full-time job. But you have to absolutely know where to draw a line. It's not at all easy. There's a wonderful scene, and I really recommend the movie for those of you who haven't seen it. There's a movie that came out a number of years ago called Habilti Rishumiyim, the Unofficials. And it describes the origin of Shas, the political party. It was started by a printer, you know, not a rabbi, not just a guy who, a Haredi Sephardi who wanted to, a Mizrahi Jew, who wanted to get his kid into a good school that was run by Ashkenazim, and there was a quota against the Mizrahi students, and that got him to start trying to improve the lot of Mizrahi Jews in the Haredi community. By the way, those of you who might have seen Shtisa last night, that's apparently going to be one of the motifs of the new season of Shtisa, because the first episode is available for free on YouTube, so you watch it, you'll see. In any event, strikingly, in that movie, at a certain stage, you have all kinds of people who are coming to the various founders of Shas and handing them envelopes full of money for good reasons, for good purposes, to finance their campaigns and to for yeshivas or whatever the case might be. The guy who founded Shas says, "No, I'm not doing it. I'm not taking the money. I refuse." That was his draw line. Now, at the end, he ended up paying a price for it because he was pushed out of Shas. But, by the same token, he maintained his integrity. I think that's what Al Tidvada LaRashut means. There's another example, which may very well be relevant as well. It's a very interesting passage in a book called Sefer HaKabbalah. Sefer HaKabbalah has got nothing to do with mysticism. It's a history book. It was written in the 12th century by a man whose name was Rav Avraham Ibn Daud in the 1170s, 1180s. He himself was from a family that was driven out of southern Spain by the fanatic Almohad Muslims, and he settled in Toledo. He was actually a philosopher. He wasn't a mystic, and he wrote a history book. Well, a history book of the Torah Sheba'al Peh from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu until his time. And he tells the following story, which is really striking. It's, again, Al Tidvada LaRashut. He spends a lot of time discussing the personality and the career of Samuel ibn Nagraila, Shmuel HaNagid, who was the wazir, the sort of like prime minister and the commander of the hosts of the city state of Granada, a great poet, a great Talmud Chacham. One of the more interesting things about him is we know that on one occasion before a great battle, he didn't have time to have minchas, he wrote a poem instead. I always wondered, like, how many Rosh Yeshiva would get away with that today, that they would, instead of having mincha, they would write a poem. Anyways, But if you read his poetry, and I strongly recommend reading his poetry, and it's been translated. Some of it's been translated into English. Shmuel HaNagid was a person who had a very, what shall we call it, very positive self-image. I mean, he really had a positive self-image. On one occasion, he said, "Ani Dor David Bedori, I am the greatest combination of poet and." Poet and military commander since David HaMelech. Well, that's not a small business. And yet it's interesting when he comes to describe the end of the career of Shmuel HaNagid, Ibn Daud talks about how he gave so much tzedakah and he supported Talmidei Chachamim and all kinds of stuff, and he says, and his in his place became, in other words, he succeeded by his son, Yosef HaNagid, Yosef HaLevi HaNagid. And says Ibn Daud, of all the wonderful characteristics that were true of Shmuel HaNagid, Yosef had all of them except for one. He wasn't humble. He wasn't modest. Now, anybody knows anything about Shmuel HaNagid reads this thing and says, huh? What are you talking about? I mean, let's be kind. He was a person with a very positive self-image. And then Ibn Daud continues and says, and as a result, the Muslim rulers, they were actually Berbers, Muslim rulers of Granada were jealous of him, and as a result they overthrew him, and they murdered him, and they killed all the Jews, and they threw them out, and it was a terrible, terrible thing. Actually, it happened, if you really must know, it happened on the 9th of Tevet, which is Thursday, in the year 1066. If you want to put that into perspective, while William the Conqueror was busy crossing the Channel to conquer England, so this happened to the Jews. Later that year, this happened to the Jews of Granada. So what's this got to do with what we're talking about, and what in general is this? Apparently, there was a fundamental difference between Shmuel HaNagid and his son. Shmuel HaNagid, as a non-Muslim, serving in an exalted position in the Muslim government, knew exactly what the actual limits of his authority were and of his place at court. And he knew not to overdo it. He knew not to be tempted by the attractive elements in the job that he filled in court life. He knew where to draw the line. He knew not to get corrupted. He knew not to endanger the rest of the Jewish people by doing something which perhaps might generate the anti-Jewish riot. So he was part of the Rashut, but who lo yitvada l'Rashut. He knew that there was what he could do and what he couldn't do, and he knew that he was a Jew, and he had to keep his distance, be able, in order for the sake of his people as well. Yosef grew up with a silver spoon in his mouth. And he, as far as he was concerned, he was no different than anybody else, and he was arrogant, and he lorded it over the other Muslims, and he lorded it over the Jews, and he paid a price for that. So, politics is a very dangerous, necessary, but dangerous thing. I don't think that Shmaya is saying, don't go into politics. Don't go into public service. That's critical. We have to go to public service. The more good people go in, the better the system will be. Don't go native. Work overtime to maintain your principles, to maintain your integrity. And take a break if you need to. But that balance is what Shmaya is talking about. That is, I think, where Avtalion picks up where Shmaya leaves off. In his day, Shmaya and Avtalion are exact contemporaries of Herod. Herod, one of the more problematic figures in Jewish history. On the one hand, a ruthless, murderous tyrant. On the other hand, the same guy built the Beit HaMikdash and received all kinds of praise from the rabbis for it. So, I guess that's a mix. But in his day, it was dangerous to talk about certain things. The idea that everything is good nowadays, everything you say is going to be on Twitter within 30 seconds, and anything that's on Twitter once is up there forever, and it doesn't matter how fast you delete things. So perhaps things didn't go that quickly, but in Herod's day, if you criticized Herod, you could find yourself in jail very quickly, relatively quickly, and then exiled. Now, if you're an individual, you'll pay a price. So you should always be careful what you say anyway. And here, there's a very serious problem with social media because adrenaline works there more than anything else. Maybe we should really spend an entire shiur on the ethics of social media and how what to do and what not to do, and where to draw the line. I do, in the meantime, I recommend highly. I can't recommend it too highly. Rabbi Daniel Feldman of Yeshiva University, one of the Rosh Yeshiva at YU, has written a wonderful book. I think I mentioned it. If not, I should have. Called False Facts and True Rumors, in which he talks about the etiquette and of the internet and the question of Lashon Hara and Rechilot, gossip and tale-bearing, and the internet. So I very, very, very strongly recommend that. Anyways, let's come back to the situation. So Atalia says, look it, you know, you got to be careful what you say. First of all, you don't want to be misunderstood. And this comes back to a certain degree to the first Mishnah, where Chazal say, where the Real Sheikh and the Sagdola say, Hevu Mitanum Badin, think before you talk. There's a famous statement that's attributed to the Kotzker Rebbe. Could be, and then I heard other people who said it. So it's one of these things that, I don't know if he said it or somebody else said it, but it certainly was worth saying. The Kotzker once said that not everything that you think should be said. Not everything that you say should be written. Not everything that you write should be published. That's good. That's good advice in general. Especially true in a world wherein people really don't listen to what you say. They categorize it automatically, and they will say you're and judge you either as in and out, because we live in a binary Manichaean kind of existence today. But Avtalian says, look it, if you're a teacher, and think about this for a minute, says if you're a teacher and you say something which is misinterpreted or which is edited or which is, you know, just a small piece is put on the internet, so in his time, you're talking about exile, and your students will follow you, and then they'll end up living in bad circumstances, and they may end up getting lost along the way. But in contemporary circumstances, how many times have we heard that agenda-driven individuals or so-called journalists find one sentence that's said by a Rav, which likely was taken out of context, or was expressed in words that are not understandable outside of the Beit Midrash, because there is the language of the Beit Midrash and there is the language of Torah, which is not the normal koine that everybody speaks. There was a great, I don't know how many of you have ever heard of him, but he's certainly another person you should get to know. He's passed away, but there was a wonderful, wonderful, fascinating guy who I love to read, whose name was Adam Baruch. Adam Baruch, his real name was Baruch Rosenblum. He was the grandson of the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Me'ah Sharim. And then he left religion, he didn't leave religion. In the end, he was an art critic. Every week he had a very, very long and fascinating full-page column in Ma'ariv, whose name I can't remember right now. But he wrote a number of books collecting those essays. He was something quite a Talmud Chacham, and was sort of like a secular posek. People who he would teach Torah in a way that was accessible to Chilonim. He was one of the people that really brought Rav Avadya Yosef to the attention of the broader secular or non-Orthodox community. Not in the sense as a politician, everybody knew Rav Avadya, but he really went through Yabia Omer and Yechavedah to tell people who this person really was. So. Baruch was a real, he's a terrible loss to Israeli cultural scene. Anyways, he used to say, and it's true, that everybody in this country speaks Hebrew, or tries to speak Hebrew. However, it ain't the same language. A lot of people, especially people from traditional or religious circles, speak Jewish. They speak Yehudit. Israeli Chilonim, who don't have much of, whose Jewish literature is relatively limited, if not non-existent, speak Israelit. So Israeli and Jewish are not necessarily the same language. So you have people go in and they quote rabbis and teachers who say Aleph Bet Gimel Dalet Hey, and in Israeli it means one thing, and Yehudit it means something else. And that's exactly what Avtalya is warning against. Be careful what you say, because interested parties will misquote you or quote you, not understand what you're saying, and you're going to pay a price. And the Torah will pay a price. Now, this is part of a longer discussion. I mean, I've been yelling for years. Hopefully someday I'll be able to do it. There is a problem certainly in the religious world, being able to present Judaism in a way which is accessible to an intelligent person with a Western education, and to counterattack from a traditional point of view in the cultural wars that are here and certainly in the United States. That's part of this as well. Either way, public of Shemayim v'Avtalya are here four square trying to answer the question, how does a person who is talented, who is learned, maintain a public posture, contribute to society, maybe go into politics, while maintaining their integrity and not desecrating God's name. It's a challenge, and I don't think either of them really gives answers here. Al tidvad al reshut, this question is up to you. But I'd like to close with something a little bit more positive. Avtalian says what? Sages, scholars, be careful with what you say, lest you be obliged to go into exile, and you will go into exile in a place where the waters, obviously, the cultural waters, are evil. V'yishtua talmidim abayim achrechem v'yamutu. And the students who follow you will drink from those waters as well as what you're teaching. Avtalion here assumes something which deserves extra attention. Give me an extra 2 minutes. I hope you won't mind. Talmidim, teachers desperately need students. They can't live without students. Shakespeare has a wonderful, beautiful line in Romeo and Juliet, where Juliet says that the giving heart is the heart which has to keep giving and giving and giving, and if it doesn't give away of itself, it will shrivel up and die. That is the nature of the real teacher, who cannot stop teaching, and if he can't, he might as well shrivel up and die. He or she might as well shrivel up and die. So Avtalion assumes that the students will follow the teacher, and where the teacher lives is going to be is part of his responsibility, because he's responsible for the souls of the students as well. That idea, that dynamic, is actually it's rooted in halacha. It's not just a reality. It's not just a question. I follow a person I like to study with, captured by his charisma. There is a rule in the book of Bamidbar, and it's discussed in length in Masech Demakot, that if a person commits manslaughter, then they go into exile. They have to exile themselves to one of six. There were three on each side of the Jordan, six cities of refuge, where they are allowed to live, and their lives are protected, but they're restricted to that city, and for the 2,000 cubit area around it, the Tum Shabbat, until the Kohen Gadol dies. But in other words, you're basically going into, it's not jail, you're going to, and that's not a prison camp either, it's a city, but you're going to internal exile. It's the Soviets made a thing out of this, but this is a lot nicer. What are the conditions? Now, the Torah says that when you go into exile like that, you have to live there. So Chazal derived from that. From that pasuk that you have to live there, that we or the country is obligated, the system is obligated to provide the student, person convicted of manslaughter, unintentional manslaughter, not criminal manslaughter, unintentional manslaughter, with all of their basic needs. The Gemara basically restricts those things to physical amenities. You have to have a live. You have to be in a, you know, yeah. You don't just throw them in the street. You have to get a place to live and whatever. The Rambam says, this is chapter 7 of Hilchot Rotzeach Ushmirat Nefesh Halacha Aleph. Talmid shegala le'ir miklat. A person was a student, and he committed involuntary manslaughter. And as a result, he was sentenced to go live in a city of refuge, near miklat. Rabo maglim rabo imo. You make his teacher go live with him. Shene'emar v'chai. That he's supposed to live there. But we thought that was just food and shelter and stuff. Says the Rambam. Aselo k'dei shi'ichye. Give him the conditions which allow him to live. V'chaye balei chokhma, and the life of those who have wisdom, who seek wisdom, u'mevaksheha, and those who seek wisdom, below Talmud Torah, without studying Torah, kemita chashuvim. It's spiritual death. You were obliged to provide an ability for the students to continue learning Torah. Without being able to learn, you might as well be dead. V'chein, and the Rambam says, exactly the same way, if the teacher is guilty of involuntary manslaughter, harav shegalam maglim yeshivato imo, if a Rosh Hashiva or a Rav or a teacher is forced to live in the city of refuge, his entire yeshiva goes and lives with him too. Because the teacher can't exist without his students. It's non-negotiable. It's as much as important as eating and drinking and having a place to live and a bed to sleep in. That's not life. So Avtalion is saying, he's already reflecting this. I mean, so the question is, where did the Rambam get this? It's not in the Gemara. So they find all kinds of sources. I think it's in this Mishnah. Because Avtalia assumes that wherever the teacher goes, the students are going to go after them because they can't live without it. The idea was put beautifully in a eulogy that was offered in April of 1993 for Rav Soloveitchik by his son, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik. At the end of that eulogy, Professor Soloveitchik asked the rhetorical question, what was it? That so many, I mean, Rav Soloveitchik was taught many, 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 many people, especially this year in New York, but not just, as a Bostonian, I can tell you that, from 1941 until he retired in 1985. So that's 44 years. There were hundreds of students in Talmidim in the Shir. And there were good students, medium students, this one, and that could, all kinds of people. Of all kinds of temperament and all kinds of ability. And so at the end of the eulogy, Professor Soloveitchik asked, what bounded them together? Because those people who sat with Professor Soloveitchik, this is true of, I'm sure, of other relations between masters and disciples, for them, their time with whoever their teacher was transformative. Not just formative, but transformative. If you talk to a person who was in Rav Soloveitchik's shir, whether it was in the 40s, and there are still some people like that, in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, even the 80s, early 80s, he fills an amazing place in their persona. So Rav Soloveitchik said, not apropos, this Rambam the same, but he made a similar point. He said, that the Rav knew, that his Talmidim knew, that without him, they could not be. And they knew that he knew that without them, Rav Soloveitchik could not be himself. And that mutual, intimate, profound dependency caused them to bond in a way that is very, very unusual in contemporary society, and yet explains that he's fully understood and understandable against the background of this Rambam. When the Rebbe goes away, you follow him because your life is him. This is not a cult. This is not, you know, give me all your money and then whatever. But there are bonds, like the parental bond, which are absolutely not describable, they're formative, they're transformative, and they're at the root of what we call tradition. And everybody who is part of the Shalshalat HaMasorah, the chain of tradition, is obligated to watch, to see themselves as a representative of that tradition, and therefore to watch their integrity, to watch their soul, and to watch what they say. Okay, that's it for today. As always, if you want to, if you have questions, you can put them in the comments. You can send me a PM. You can whatever you want. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook if you like. There's more stuff coming, actually, and we will see you. We will see you next week.